I still think we're straining at the limits of debate rules here, but I will answer your question. There are no absolutes outside of God.
So in other words, the fact that God is good is something that God told you, and that's why you accept it, rather than knowing it ahead and assuming it as a presupposition, which you said a minute ago.
That's extremely simplistic. God told it to me, and he provided evidence of it.
But you also said it was a presupposition.
That's right.
Isn't that a contradiction?
Oh, not at all. There are many things which are presupposed as well as evidenced in this world. For instance, the laws of logic.
I would disagree with that, but... I still have some time. All right. When we talk about immaterial things, are you also saying that there's such a thing as, let's say, ghosts or the soul, which are another example of immaterial things? Would you call them immaterial?
I would say that man is a living soul and has an immaterial aspect to his being, yes.
Mm-hmm. And how would you prove this?
Does this have to do with the existence of God now?
Well, it has to do with the existence of immaterial things.
Well, if there's an immaterial being, God, and if the Bible is his word, then I would say that his revealing the nature of man in the Bible is sufficient proof. And that takes us back logically, as you'll be bound to say, to whether God himself does exist. And that's what we're supposed to be debating.
Okay, so you're giving me a circular argument, which is...
No, I'm telling you what the debate is about. Basically.
Well, I know what the debate is about.
Yeah.
I'm asking for an answer to a question, and I didn't get one. Oh,
no,
I'm not
debating the nature of the soul tonight, but the existence of God. Yes, I believe in the man has a soul.
Okay, the only reason I asked about the soul is because this is a simpler immaterial object that most people would hold is also immaterial.
Well, I don't say that it's similar. I mean, that's your claim.
Simpler, I said, not similar.
Okay.
Okay,
having concluded our segment of cross-examination, we will now begin final rebuttals for segment number one. Dr. Bonson, I now turn to you for an 8-minute rebuttal.
Thank you. Dr. Stein is not into this debate yet tonight. We are debating the nature of, the existence of God. I specified that I would be speaking in order to avoid logical contradiction of one particular view of God, the Christian view of God, which I personally hold. Dr. Stein says that he will not restrict himself to the Christian conception of God. Well, that's fine, he may not, but all the time he uses on anything that's not the Christian conception of God will be irrelevant. In fact, I will join him in refuting those other conceptions of God. The existence of God that I'm arguing tonight is the Christian one. Secondly, when Dr. Stein defines an atheist as one who finds the theistic proofs inadequate, that is unproven but not disproven, he's engaging in linguistic revision. He does quote for us, of course, two atheists who likewise define atheism that way. But you see, that strikes me as similar to a Christian who defines his position as being true at the outset, and therefore it must be true because it's true by definition. He has minimized the task that is before him by simply saying, I'm here to show that the theistic proofs are inadequate. Well, you see, even at that, though, he didn't do his job, even though that was less than what he really should be doing. Because he gave us 11 basic proofs for God, attributing one to me that I didn't use and do not use, and did not assume. He mentioned 11 basic proofs, but did not deal with the one that I gave in my opening presentation. And so he has not dealt yet with the argument that is before us this evening. Dr. Stein has mentioned logical binds and logical self-contradictions. He says that he holds that the laws of logic are universal, but, however, they are conventional in nature. That is not at all acceptable philosophically. If the laws of logic are conventional in nature, then you might have different societies that use different laws of logic. It might be appropriate in some society to say both my car is in the parking lot and it's not the case that my car is in the parking lot. That is, certain societies that have a convention that says go ahead and contradict yourself. But there are, in a sense, subgroups within our own society that might think that way. Thieves have a tendency to say, this is not my wallet, but it's not the case that it's not my wallet. They might engage in contradictions like that, but I don't think any of us would want to accept it. The laws of logic are not conventional or not sociological. I would say the laws of logic have a transcendental necessity about them. They are universal, they are invariant, and they are not material in nature. And if they are not that, then I'd like to know, in an atheist universe, how it's possible to have laws in the first place, and secondly, how it's possible to justify those laws. The laws of logic, you see, are abstract. As abstract entities, which is the appropriate philosophical term, not spiritual entities, as Dr. Stein is speaking of, as abstract entities, that is to say, non-individual or universal in character, they are not materialistic. As universal, they are not experienced to be true. There may be experiences whereby the laws of logic are used, but no one has universal experience. No one has tried every possible instance of a law of logic. As invariant, they don't fit into what most materialists would tell us about the constantly changing nature of the world. And so, you see, we have a real problem on our hands. Dr. Stein wants to use the laws of logic tonight. I maintain in so doing he's borrowing my worldview. For you see, within the theistic worldview, laws of logic make sense. Within the theistic worldview, there can be abstract, universal, invariant entities, such as the laws of logic. Within the theistic worldview, you cannot contradict yourself, because to so do, you engage in the nature of lying, and that's contrary to the character of God as we perceive it. And so the laws of logic are something that Dr. Stein is going to have to explain as an atheist, or else relinquish using them. The transcendental argument for the existence of God, then, which Dr. Stein has yet to touch, and which I don't believe he can surmount, is that without the existence of God, it's impossible to prove anything. And that's because in the atheistic world, you cannot justify and cannot account for laws in general, laws of thought in particular, laws of nature, cannot account for the human mind and the fact that it's more than electrochemical complexes and events, and cannot give us moral absolutes. That is to say, in the atheist conception of the world, there's really no reason to debate, because in the end, as Dr. Stein has said, all these laws are conventional. All these laws are not really law-like in their nature. They're just, well, if you're an atheist and a materialist, you'd have to say they're just something that happens inside the brain. But you see, what happens inside your brain is not the same as what happens inside my brain, and so what happens inside of your brain is not a law. It doesn't necessarily correspond to what happens in mine. In fact, it can't be identical with what is inside of my mind or brain, because we don't have the same brains. If the laws of logic come down to being materialistic entities, then they no longer have their law-like character. If they are only social conventions, then, of course, what we might do tonight to win the debate is just define a new set of laws, and we'll say all those who want the convention that says atheism must be true, or theism must be true, and we have the following laws, which we conventionally adopt to prove it, you see, we'll be satisfied. But no one is satisfied. That's not a rational procedure to follow. The laws of logic cannot be avoided. The laws of logic cannot be accounted for in a materialistic universe. Therefore, the laws of logic are one of many evidences that without God, you can't prove anything at all.
Thank you, Dr. Bonson. Dr. Stein, your 8-minute rebuttal, please.
Okay, I'll now touch on transcendental evidence, the existence of God, which is, I think, the only time I could really do such is in my rebuttal. But first, I'd like to do one more important thing. Rather than asking what is the cause of the universe, we must first ask, does the universe require a causal explanation? Rather than asking what is responsible for design in nature, we must ask, does nature exhibit design? God is given as a solution to a metaphysical problem, but no consideration is given to whether such a problem exists in the first place. But God is not an explanation for anything. For example, if I ask you, how did the universe come? And you say, God created it. That doesn't answer the question. The question is, how did God create it? And I defy any theist to explain how God created it. Basically, what you're saying is that an unknowable being is responsible for a given phenomenon which he caused through unknowable means. And that's not an explanation, but rather a concession that the phenomenon is totally inexplicable. Now, about the laws of science. An atheist world, first of all, I don't think that Dr. Bonson understands what a scientific law is. A scientific law is an observation that's made over and over and over again. The law of gravitation, we drop objects all over the world in different situations, and we always observe that they fall to the earth. So eventually we make a statistical statement that objects are likely, almost 100% likely, to fall to the earth if they're not accelerating in the opposite direction. Okay? In other words, a rocket doesn't fall to the earth immediately, but eventually will if it doesn't escape the gravity of the earth. So these scientific laws are merely consensuses based on thousands and hundreds of thousands of observations. The laws of logic are also consensuses based on observations. The fact that they can predict something correctly shows us that we're on the right track, that we're corresponding to reality in some way. If I can plug in a formula and show exactly where a cannonball is going to land and predict exactly where it will strike, then my mathematics is reflecting something valid about the behavior of cannonballs that are fired on this earth. Otherwise, I wouldn't have picked the exact spot. And mathematics is basically logic, again, used in the same way by consensus of tested things that are self-verifying. I'm not explaining it as well as I could, but that's basically what I'm saying. An atheist universe, then, goes on the basis of the fact that matter has certain intrinsic behavior patterns. Electrons repel each other because they're both negatively charged. Protons repel each other. An electron and a proton attract each other. The opposite poles of a magnet do that. That's an inherent property of matter. That is what produces the regularity in the universe. If there were no regularity, then there would be no science possible because you couldn't predict anything. Matter wouldn't behave the same the second time as it did the first time, or the third, or the fourth. So the lack of having a God is in no way detrimental to logic and to having laws in an atheist universe. In fact, if we had a God, we could very easily have an irrational God who did things capriciously so that if I threw a ball, one time I threw it, it would go up, and the next time down, and, you know, crash straight down and soar right up. That would be just as much evidence for a God as a regularly behaving ball or object drop. I mean, you could have a God who makes the rules and changes them from time to time, or we could have one that makes things the same, or we could have a universe that just behaves that way normally. Now, to ask what caused the universe, although we didn't get into this exact thing, I'm trying to show you that it's to ask an absurd question in the first place, to give God as the answer. First of all, I mentioned it doesn't explain anything, but secondly, before something can act as a cause, it must first exist. That is, it must be a part of the universe. And the universe sets the foundation for a causal explanation, but it cannot itself require a causal explanation. I don't know if that's clear. If I say every human being had a mother, that's a valid question. But if I ask who was the mother of the human race, that is a non-valid question because the human race didn't have a mother. I can ask what was the cause of this planet exploding, but to ask what was the cause of the universe is to ask an invalid question. And to offer the answer as God is to offer an invalid answer to an invalid question. We haven't gotten into morality. I think I'm going to leave that for the second half. If Dr. Bonson doesn't raise it, I will. He makes an awful lot of statements that are basically feelings. He felt God entered his life. He felt that this happened. He felt that Jesus was resurrected. If he were held to the historian's standard, especially the standard required when a miracle is done, as David Hume said, when a miraculous or very unlikely event, such as the resurrection, although Hume didn't use that exact analogy, that exact example, occurs, we must demand an extraordinary amount of proof. If I say that the sun is going to rise tomorrow, we don't need too much proof because it's rising every day. If I say the sun is not going to rise tomorrow, then we need an extraordinary amount of evidence before someone will take that seriously because it's an unusual event. Okay? Now, he has not held up the historian's standard to a lot of the things he's accepting from the Bible as evidence for God. And I think that if he did so, he would soon see that those evidences dried up. Now, to get to transcendental evidence, finally. The statement that if God did not exist, we couldn't prove anything, and that logic and scientific laws would be invalid is absolute nonsense, and I think I've demonstrated part of that. He says that laws of logic are the same everywhere. This is not true, although they are mostly the same. And I wonder if he's ever heard of a Zen cone. And the answer to a Zen cone is something which, like, now, what is the sound of one hand clapping is the most famous Zen cone. The answer to that kind of a question is in a different type of logic, in a sense, or it's extra logical, if you want to call it that. But I do think that most logic, as we accept it in the Western world and most of the Eastern world, is basis of agreement on people that reflects something about the universe. The idea that transcendental evidence of the existence of God is that the impossibility of the opposite, that the world view would not be rational if it were atheistic, is total nonsense. And I've demonstrated to you that it depends on the inherent properties of matter. If matter has the properties where it behaves regularly, then we have order in the universe, and we have a logical, rational universe without a God. The God issue is not germane if matter behaves in a regular way. And I would hold that the properties of matter, as demonstrated over and over again, are regular. And it's an inherent property of matter. So I think that the transcendental evidence statement can be dismissed as mere wishful thinking coupled with misinformation about what scientific laws are and what atheists would hold. In fact, science itself is atheistic. Science is not allowed to use a supernatural explanation for anything. And there's a very good reason for that. If your experiment came out one way, you could say God did it. If it came out the opposite way, you could say God did that. You would never make any progress in explaining anything in science, and so the agree-upon consensus for rules in science is that naturalistic explanations only are asked for and allowed.
Okay, we have concluded segment number one of this evening's debate. We will now enter segment number two of this evening's debate. Dr. Stein will open segment number two with a 10-minute opening statement.
He will if he can find his notes. Now, it would be logically wrong to say that if all of the proofs fail for the existence of God, that one is justified in saying that there is no God. There's a logical fallacy, argumentum ad ignorantum or something like that, to say that you accept something just because all the evidence to the contrary fails. However, we have two other factors here that we must consider. One of them is the fact that 900 years have passed since Anselm first postulated the ontological proof and Thomas Aquinas in 1200 or so. So we have a long period of time in which all these proofs that are being professed fail. That's some evidence about probability of there being a proof that someone will come up with that will succeed, being pretty unlikely. In addition, we have a number of things which I wouldn't call proofs, but I would call evidence, which make the existence of God even more improbable. And one of them is the problem of evil. If an all-good God exists, why is there evil in the world? We are told with God that all things are possible. If all things are possible, it would be possible for him to create a world in which the vast mass of suffering that is morally pointless, such as the pain and misery of animals, the cancer and blindness of little children, the humiliations of senility and insanity, were avoided. These are apparently inflictions of the Creator himself, or else we have a God that isn't omnipotent. If you admit that, then you deny his goodness. If you say that he would not have done otherwise, you deny with him things that are possible, all things that are possible. So the atheist can present several arguments which sort of increase the probability that there isn't a God. They're not proofs, as I said. One of them would be the problem of evil. The idea is that the presence of evil is incompatible with an all-good, all-knowing, and all-powerful God, as Dr. Bahnsen suggested he believes in. Now, he could come up with a statement that injustice in this world may well be corrected in the next world, but that would be something that he would be making without any evidence whatsoever. Just, again, wishful thinking. He could also say that, get out of this bind by saying that God is not all-powerful, that some evil things are done without his permission, so to speak. In which case his statement that he believes in an omnipotent God is falsified. He could also say that the old argument about free will, which is basically a morass into which he may fall if he wishes, will not do. To say that God gave man free will and therefore he can choose between the evil and good is to imply that God was unable to make a man who could examine both sides and always choose the good. That, in other words, he's limited, and the only way he can do it is to let man completely choose for himself, as if that would take something away from man if he could examine both sides and still have the guidance within himself to always choose the good. Now, there's no obvious physical evidence of a God. If God wanted man to believe in him, man or woman, people, he could, all he have to do is put in an appearance before a group of people, especially a group of atheists. In fact, we invite him to our meetings to put in an appearance. And that way, anyone would believe in him except a fool. Well, the Christian says that this may sound logical to you, but it doesn't to God. God evidently wants man to believe on faith without adequate evidence. Well, if he does, then why did he give man the power of reason? And why did he give man more reason than any other animal has? If all living things on the earth were created by a God, and he was a loving God who made man in his own image, how do you explain the fact that he must have created the tapeworm, the malaria parasite, tetanus germs, polio, ticks, mosquitoes, cockroaches, and fleas? Now, surely the dog is not suffering from original sin, and needs to be infected with fleas so that he can get to doggy heaven, which would be better than his present life. The standard answer of theists to this kind of question is things have to be better after death. You know, we have these things on earth, it's a veil of tears, so to speak. Doesn't make much sense. I mean, any God that would punish a man for what his ancestors did is not a very moral God. I'm talking about original sin now, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. There are many instances on the earth in which no distinction seems to be made between the innocent and the guilty, between the Christian and the non-believer. For example, in natural disasters like an earthquake or a fire, it kills Christians, it kills babies, it kills animals, it kills non-Christians. You certainly can't say that these people were punished in some way for something that they did. It also demolishes churches and hospitals without distinction. Isn't this evidence that at the very least, whatever force there is controlling these things doesn't care if people are Christians or not, or whether they're innocent or not? If there's only one God and he cares at all how he's worshipped, why are there so many different conceptions of God and so many different religions, all claiming to be the one true religion? Does this mean that they're all mistaken? Does it mean that one is correct and all the others are mistaken? There's an old joke about an atheist in which he said to a believer, you know, you believe that 99 of the 100 gods are false. I just go one step further and say that the 100th one is also false. So I'm sure that Dr. Bonson, in fact, he even agreed that he would help me refute any other gods but the Christian God. If Christianity is the one true religion, why are so many people who sincerely believe in it found in prisons, slums, and in organized crime? I'm not saying that all people there are Christians. I'm not saying that all people in organized crime are Christians either. But it evidently, if Christianity led to an elevation of moral standards, which we haven't gotten into yet about morality, but I'm going to jump the gun here a little bit, Christians would be expected to be highly moral, not less moral. In fact, studies of the religious beliefs of prisoners have shown that almost all were devout Christians. The number of atheists is less than 1%. And these statistics were, in fact, so disturbing to the people who conducted them that they stopped collecting them recently. Can't argue with the facts, though. Any system which seems to fail in its application as frequently as Christianity does is not a very good or practical system for mankind to follow. I don't want to get into a real discussion of Christianity, except that Dr. Bonson insists that the Christian God and Jesus and the other evidences that come from the Christian God, concomitants with them, are true and the others are not. What are we left with after this exercise? Well, we can see that we can't prove the existence of God by any rational or logical process, and Dr. Bonson has not offered us any. We have a factual issue here. Again, as I said, because the proofs fail, it doesn't mean that the existence is disproved. But I think it certainly is unproved. We can As I will say in my closing statement, this does not leave us in a bleak and horrible world. There are many, many things that the atheist does with his life which make this world a nice place and enable him to get to the solving of the problems of this world instead of hoping for pie in the sky, which does not seem to be very probable.
Thank you, Dr. Stein. Dr. Bonson, can we please have your 10-minute opening statement?
You've heard Dr. Stein refer to the transcendental argument and tried to dismiss it simply as wishful thinking. If our debate is going to degenerate to that level, then I dismiss everything that he has said as wishful thinking and delusion, and why don't we all go home? No, we're here to argue. We're here to argue a point, and I'm going to say just what the argument that has been proposed and see if Dr. Stein has any better answer than just to engage in name-calling. Dr. Stein proposes an atheist worldview. I propose a Christian theistic worldview. There are other proposals out there that may want their evening to debate as well. I'm maintaining that the proof of the Christian worldview is that the denial of it leads to irrationality. That is, without the Christian God, you cannot prove anything. As one illustration of that, although I want to get into more than that in the second speech, I have referred to the laws of logic. An atheist universe cannot account for the laws of logic. Dr. Stein, interestingly, in responding to that, spoke more about scientific law than he did about the laws of logic, and I'm going to come back to that in my rebuttal to ask about his understanding of scientific law. However, we still hear him saying that laws of logic are a matter of consensus and are just this way. That is to say, I don't have to prove that the laws of logic exist or that they are justified. It's just this way. Now, friends, how would you like it if I would have conducted the debate in that fashion this evening? God exists because it's just that way. You just can't avoid it. You see, that's not debate, that's not argument, and it's not rational. And therefore, we have, interestingly, an illustration in our very debate tonight that atheists cannot sustain a rational approach to this question. What are the laws of logic, Dr. Stein, and how are they justified? We still have to answer that question from a materialist standpoint. From a Christian standpoint, we have an answer, obviously. They reflect the thinking of God. They are, if you will, a reflection of the way God thinks and expects us to think. But if you don't take that approach and want to justify the laws of logic in some a priori fashion, that is, apart from experience, sometimes that suggests when he says these things are self-verified, then we can ask why the laws of logic are universal, unchanging, and invariant truths. Why they, in fact, apply repeatedly in the realm of contingent experience. Dr. Stein told you, well, we use the laws of logic because we can make accurate predictions using them. Well, as a matter of fact, that doesn't come anywhere close to discussing the vast majority of the laws of logic. That isn't the way they are proven. It's very difficult to conduct experiments on the laws of logic of that sort. They are more conceptual in nature rather than empirical or predicting certain outcome in empirical experience. But even if you want to try to justify all of them in that way, we have to ask, why is it that they apply repeatedly in a contingent realm of experience? Why in a world that is random, not subject to personal order, as I believe, Christian God, why is it that the laws of logic continue to have that success-generating feature about them? Why should they be assumed to have anything to do with the realm of history? Or why should reasoning about history or science or empirical experience have these laws of thought imposed upon it? Once again, we have to come back to this really unacceptable idea that they're conventional. If they are conventional, then of course there ought to be just numerous approaches to scholarship everywhere, different approaches to history, to science, and so forth, because people just adopt different laws of logic. That just isn't the way scholarship proceeds, and if anybody thinks that is adequate, then they just need to go to the library and read a bit more. The laws of logic are not treated as conventions. To say that they are merely conventions is simply to say, I haven't got an answer.
Now, if you want to justify logical truths along a posteriori lines, that is, rather than arguing that they're self-evident, but rather arguing that there's evidence for them that we can find in experience or by observation, that approach was used, by the way, by John Stuart Mill. People will say we gain confidence in the laws of logic through repeated experience, and that experience is generalized. But in some weaker moments, I think Dr. Stein was trying to say that. Of course, some of the suggested logical truths, it turns out, are so complex or so unusual that it's difficult to believe anyone has perceived their instances in experience. But even if we restrict our attention to the other, more simple laws of logic, it should be seen that if their truth cannot be decided independently of experience, then they actually become contingent. That is, if people cannot justify the laws of logic independent of experience, then you can only say they apply, as far as I know, in the past experience that I've had. They are contingent, they lose their necessity, universality, and invariance. Why should a law of logic, which is verified in one domain of experience, by the way, be taken as true for unexperienced domains as well? Why should we universalize or generalize about the laws of logic, especially in a materialistic universe not subject to the control of a personal God? Now, it turns out if the a priori and the a posteriori lines of justification for logical truths are unconvincing, as I'm suggesting briefly they both are, perhaps we could say they are linguistic conventions about certain symbols. Certain philosophers have suggested that. The laws of logic would not be taken as inexorably dictated, but rather we impose their necessity on our language. They become, therefore, somewhat like rules of grammar. And as John Dewey pointed out so persuasively earlier in the century, laws of grammar, you see, are just culturally relative. If the laws of logic are like grammar, then the laws of logic are culturally relative, too. Why, then, are not contradictory systems deemed equally rational? If the laws of logic can be made culturally relative, then we can win the debate by simply stipulating a law of logic that says anybody who argues in this way has got a tautology on his hands, and therefore it's true. Why are arbitrary conventions like the logical truths so useful if they're only conventional? Why are they so useful in dealing with problems in the world of experience? You see, we must ask whether the atheist has a rational basis for his claims. Atheists love to talk about laws of science, laws of logic. They speak as though there are certain moral absolutes for which Christians were just a few minutes ago being indicted because they didn't live up to them. But who is the atheist to tell us about laws? In a materialist universe, there are no laws, much less laws of morality that anybody has to live up to. When we consider that the lectures and essays that are written by logicians and others are not likely filled with just uninterrupted series of tautologies, we can examine those propositions which logicians are most concerned to convey. For instance, logicians will say things like a proposition has the opposite truth value from its negation. Now, when we look at those kind of propositions, we have to ask the general question, what type of evidence do people have for that kind of teaching? Is it the same sort of evidence that's utilized by the biologist, by the mathematician, the lawyer, the mechanic, by your beautician? What is it that justifies the law of logic, or even belief that there is such a thing? What is a law of logic, after all? There's no agreement on that question. If we had universal agreement, perhaps it'd be silly to ask the question. It's been suggested to you that it's absurd to ask these sorts of things, although the analogy that was used by Dr. Stein about the absurdity of asking about the cause of the world is not at all relevant, because that isn't what my argument is. By the way, that's not absurd to ask that question either. It may be unnecessary to ask it if you're an atheist, but it's certainly not absurd to ask it. But it isn't absurd to ask the question that I'm asking about logic. You see, logicians are having a great deal of difficulty deciding on the nature of their claims. Anybody who reads in the philosophy of logic must be impressed with that today. Some say that the laws of logic are inferences comprised of judgments made up of concepts. Others say that they are arguments comprised of propositions made up of terms. Others say they are proof comprised of sentences made up of names. Others would simply say they are electrochemical processes in the brain. In the end, what you think the laws of logic are will determine the nature of evidence that you will suggest for them. Now, in an atheist universe, what are the laws of logic? How can they be universal, abstract, invariant? And how does an atheist justify the use of them? Are they merely conventions imposed on our experience, or are they something that reflect absolute truth? Dr. Stein tonight has wanted to use the laws of logic. I want to suggest to you one more time that Dr. Stein, in so doing, is borrowing my worldview. He's using the Christian approach to the world so that there can be such laws of logic, scientific inference, or what have you, but then he wants to deny the very foundation of it.
Thank you, Dr. Bonson. Dr. Stein, you now have an opportunity to cross-examine Dr. Bonson. This will last 4 minutes.
Is mathematics either atheistic or theistic?
Foundations of mathematics, yes.
Which?
Theistic.
Theistic?
Christian theistic.
How do you figure that?
From the impossibility of the contrary. No other worldview can justify the laws of mathematics or of logic, because no other worldview can account for universal, invariant, abstract entities such as them.
Do you think it's fair, since you pointed out that logicians themselves are in great disagreement about the nature of the laws of logic, to ask me to explain them in a way that you would find satisfactory?
Yes, it's fair.
Why?
Because this is a rational debate about worldviews. You have a naturalistic worldview, I have a supernaturalistic one. I want something even beginning to be an answer of how a naturalist can justify a universal abstract entity. I haven't heard one yet.
Okay, is logic based upon mathematics?
No.
Never? Not symbolic logic, for example?
No.
I would disagree with you.
Well, if we want to get into Russell and Whitehead and debate those issues, we'd be glad to do that. But if you ask a simple question, I can only give you a simple answer.
You said that...
Assume the opposite. As far as I'm concerned, as a Christian, I'm not committed one way or another to that. If you want to say mathematical laws and the permutation laws of math are the same as those used in logic, that's fine. How do you justify either one of them is my question.
Well, I would ask you a more fundamental question, that is, you explained that the laws of logic reflect the thinking of God. Number one, how do you know this? And number two, what does it mean?
What difficulty are you having understanding what does it mean?
I don't know how you were privy to the thinking of God.
He revealed himself through the scriptures of the Old and New Testament.
And that explains the logic.
That explains why there are universal standards of reasoning, yes.
It doesn't explain them to me. Could you explain them again?
Yeah, we have Bible studies from time to time where those things can be delved into.
You mean you spend some time rationalizing the irreconcilable, or reconciling the irreconcilable?
Like
the two accounts in Genesis, the two pedigrees of...
This is a cross-examination. If you have something other than a rhetorical question, I'll try to answer it.
Well, it's not intended as a rhetorical question. It's intended as...
The previous one was rhetorical only.
No, it was intended to show that your last statement was disingenuous and
please limit your comments to questions.
Yes, okay. Saying that logic reflects the thinking of God is to make a non-statement. How is that an answer to anything that's relevant in this discussion?
It answers the general metaphysical issue of how there can be universal invariant abstract entities in a particular's world, a particular person's worldview. If you want to know the precise relationship, for instance, if somebody wants to know how did God make a cow, okay, the statement that God made the cow doesn't have meaning apart from my being able to explain the mechanics of God making a cow. Likewise, the statement that the laws of logic are intelligible within a Christian theistic universe has meaning because there are things which are, in fact, spiritual, immaterial, and have a universal quality, such as God's thinking and those standards that he imposes on people. And so again, we can at least metaphysically make sense of invariant abstract entities in one universe, whereas we can't make sense of them at all in the other. We're not asking for the mechanics here or anything precise such as resolving the relationship of logic to math and that sort of thing. I'm simply asking a more general question. If you're an atheist, how in the atheist universe is it possible to have an abstract universal law?
Thank you, Dr. Stein. Dr. Bonson, you now have a four-minute opportunity to cross-examine Dr. Stein.
Hey, Dr. Stein, you made reference to David Hume and his rejection of miracles. Have you also read David Hume in his discussion of induction, or more popularly, the uniformity of nature?
Long time ago. I can't recall exactly what he said. I have read David Hume.
All right. Were you convinced a long time ago that you had an answer to Hume's skepticism about induction?
Can't answer that question honestly. I don't remember what. This is at least 15 years ago that I read this.
Scientific laws were, the validity of scientific laws were undermined by Hume when he contended that we have no rational basis for expecting the future to be like the past, or if you will, to be types of events, so that one event happening can be understood as a type of event, so where it's seen happening somewhere else, the same consequence can be expected from similar causation. Hume said we had no rational basis for that.
Can we have a question, please, for Dr. Stein?
Yeah, I'm trying to set up the question.
Okay.
Hume suggested that there was no rational basis for expecting the future to be like the past, in which case science is based simply on convention, or if you will, habits of thought. Do you agree with Hume?
Not on this issue, I don't.
Do you now have an answer for Hume?
I think he was wrong about that one thing, but he was also right about a lot of other things. Nobody's perfect.
What is the basis for the uniformity of nature?
That I went through this, but I'll be glad to reiterate it.
Okay.
The uniformity of nature comes from the fact that matter has certain properties which it regularly exhibits. It's part of the nature of matter. Electrons, oppositely charged things attract, the same charges repel. There are certain valences that can fill up the shell of an atom, and that's as far as it can combine.
Do all electrons repel each other?
If they're within a certain distance of each other, yes.
Have you tested all electrons?
All electrons that have ever been tested repel each other. I have not tested all.
Have you read all the tests on electrons?
Me personally, or can I go on the witness of experts?
Have you read all of the witnesses